Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles published in November of 2025 by the Geographic Society, so I hope you enjoy the program. I'm going to begin with this article from the History and Culture section, The Roman Emperor Who Died from Eating Too Much Cheese. Lots of emperors meet ignominious ends. And then there was Antoninus Pius. It's written by Candida Moss. The Roman Empire conjures up images of military power, gladiatorial contests, and feats of engineering. But to the men who ruled, life was complicated and fraught with risk. Julius Caesar, whose power grabs laid the groundwork for the first Emperor Augustus's ascent, was not the only would-be tyrant to die violently. Some emperors ruled for just a few weeks, while others met sticky ends at the hands of trusted bodyguards and family members. For those who survived, their imperial status gave them the opportunity to indulge their whims and flex their muscles, and their obsessions were often strange indeed. From exiling their own children to introducing a tax on urine, the emperors of Rome made the most of their unfettered control. Here are some of the most ambitious, bizarre, and egotistical projects they embarked upon, and some of the most uncomfortable ways they ended their rule. Augustus banished his own daughter. In 18 BCE, the Emperor Augustus passed a sweeping set of moral reforms known as the Julian Laws, which sought to revive traditional Roman virtue by rewarding marriage and punishing adultery. For the first time in Roman history, infidelity became a public crime rather than a private scandal, one that carried the penalties of exile and property confiscation. The laws were meant to model civic discipline, but their most famous victim was Augustus's own daughter, Julia, whose glamorous and notoriously unrestrained social life soon became a public embarrassment. Ancient writers such as Suetonius, Cassius Dio, and Valerius Petercalus report that when Julia was found guilty of adultery, her father exiled her to the desolate island of Pandateria, which is modern Ventotene. According to Suetonius, she remained there for 5 years before Augustus allowed her to return to the mainland. He never recalled her from exile, however, and felt humiliated by her behavior. When one of Julia's confidants, a former enslaved woman named Phoebe, hanged herself around the same time, Augustus is said to have remarked, "I would rather have been Phoebe's father." Even if Julia was the most harshly treated, Augustus's desire to control and shape his family members did not stop there. According to Suetonius, he wrote his biography of the 12 Caesars roughly a century after Augustus's death. The emperor had a very peculiar, particular handwriting style. It was so distinctive that Augustus insisted upon teaching his heirs how to write in the same style, training them to imitate his handwriting. "This kind of scriptory micromanagement," writes Australian National University professor of classics Tom Gew, "is unique to Augustus and offers evidence of an almost obsessive desire to secure his legacy by replicating himself in his successors." Claudius tried to change the alphabet. As with Augustus's laws of virtue, the Emperor Claudius, 41 to 54 CE, also wanted to change the fundamentals of Roman society. According to Suetonius, he attempted to add new letters to the Latin alphabet. The anti-sigma, which sounded like a BS or PS, a half-H, which seems to have been a short vowel sound, and the digamma, that sounded like a W. Suetonius adds that Claudius even wrote a book to explain the theory behind them. Though this may seem audacious, ancient languages did evolve and change. It was that practice, the historian Tacitus writes, that led Claudius to attempt this shift. Tacitus remarks that it was once Claudius who discovered that not even Greek writing was begun and completed at one time that he decided to design some additional Latin characters. In her book, Empire of Letters, MIT professor Stephanie Frampton explains that Claudius's introduction of new letters was seen as part of a tradition whereby language and the alphabet developed over time. Though examples of the Claudian letters have been found in archaeological discoveries, the endeavor was effectively a failure. Suetonius writes that the letters quickly fell out of use. Even the Emperor of Rome couldn't change how people wrote. Nero forced people to listen to him perform. If Augustus was focused on managing his household and the empire, the Emperor Nero, who ruled from 54 to 68 CE, was more interested in entertaining and performance. Destined for a life in politics, Nero longed instead to tread the boards of the stage. In addition to writing poetry and appearing in chariot races, he regularly forced his subjects to attend his musical recitals. According to Suetonius, while he was singing, no one was allowed to leave the theater, even for the most urgent reasons. Suetonius adds that pregnant women went into labor and delivered infants while he was performing. Others, fatigued from applauding his efforts, attempted to escape the locked gates, which held them as a literal captive audience, risking injury by jumping from the walls of the theater. The particularly desperate, wrote Suetonius, feigned death so that they might be carried out for burial. The story is likely exaggerated, but makes for juicy gossip nonetheless. Many other stories around Nero, however, are rather less charming. His relationship with the women in his life were tinged with violence. When he tired of his controlling mother, Agrippina's political interventions, he plotted her death. After several failed poisoning attempts, he orchestrated a shipwreck that she managed to survive by swimming to shore. When news of her survival reached the emperor, he finally had her stabbed and claimed that she committed suicide. After Agrippina's death, Nero's behavior grew increasingly bloodthirsty. After divorcing and exiling his wife Octavia, he accused her of adultery and had her executed. Suetonius claimed that he kicked his second wife, Poppaea, to death while she was pregnant with his child. Like many of Suetonius's stories, this may have been invented to exaggerate Nero's cruelty. Nero's willingness to discard those close to him extended to his neighbors in the city of Rome. Many ancient historians accuse Nero of starting the Great Fire of Rome in 64 CE in order to clear the ground for his extravagant building projects. Cassius Dio writes that as the fire burned, he climbed to the roof of his palace dressed as a lyre player and sang the song The Capture of Rome. This likely false detail is the origin of the myth that Nero fiddled while Rome burned, but it cements his reputation as an obsessive musician. Vespasian had an unsavory past. Vespasian, 69-79 CE, brought stability to the Roman Empire after a year of chaotic civil war following the death of Nero. But his background was suspect. The founder of the Flavian dynasty, who is best known for conquering most of Judea during the First Jewish War, may have made his initial fortune as a slave trader, specializing in castrati, or eunuchs. Around 62 CE, the future emperor finished his term as proconsul of Africa in financial trouble. His credit was ruined, and he mortgaged his property to his brother. He turned then to commerce of the most dubious sort. Suetonius writes that Vespasian was a mango, a kind of ne'er-do-well merchant who dealt in mules. In 2002, A.B. Bosworth published a convincing argument in Classical Quarterly that the term mulio, or mule, was used to refer to those who traded in human beings, and that the mules in question were not donkeys, but young boys who had been enslaved and forcibly castrated. Eunuchs were a valuable commodity in the Roman slave trade, and if Vespasian was engaged in this kind of business, it would explain how he restored his fortunes so swiftly. Even once he became emperor, Vespasian was not averse to profiting from taboo industries. Sarah E. Bond, associate professor of ancient history at the University of Iowa, said that when the frugal Vespasian became emperor, he inherited an empire in dire financial straits. As part of his austerity measures, he reintroduced a tax on urine, an important product in the laundering and tanning industries of ancient Rome. The urine, said Bond, came from public latrines and from ceramic chamber pots emptied out into the streets from the apartments above. We don't know exactly how much money was made, she added, but in a city of 1 million, there would have been hundreds of tanners and fullers who would have needed to use these human waste products for their businesses. The tax must have generated a sizable sum for Vespasian. Both Suetonius and Cassius Dio write that when Vespasian's son, Titus, found the whole enterprise quite unbecoming of their status and expressed his revulsion, Vespasian held up a gold coin and asked Titus if they had any stench. This anecdote is the origin of the expression, "Money doesn't stink." Antoninus Pius died of a cheese overdose. Not all imperial quirks are so unrelatable. Antoninus Pius, 131-161 CE, was something of a homebody who enjoyed cheese. Mild-mannered and eminently capable, he is known to later historians as one of the good emperors, since he guided Rome through a relatively peaceful 23-year reign. Unfortunately, his love of dairy proved to be his undoing. According to the Historia Augusta, a 4th-century biographical collection, he died of a fever, which he brought upon himself by eating Alpine cheese too greedily. After taking a bath on the third day of his fever, he lay down, summoned his friends, and gave orders that Marcus Aurelius should be commended to the soldiers as emperor. Then, as if in sleep, he passed away. The Historia Augusta is our lone source for this tidbit and is known for being historically unreliable. Nevertheless, if true, Antoninus's death was one of the more sympathetic among the Roman rulers. And lastly, Valerian ended his life as a footstool. Other Roman emperors met far more bloody ends than the cheese-loving Antoninus. Nero committed suicide, Galba was murdered by his bodyguards, the Praetorians, and Geta was murdered by his brother, Caracalla, and his mother's assistant. Arguably the most degrading end fell to Valerian, who ruled in the middle of the 3rd century CE. Valerian spent most of his career fighting the Persians on the eastern frontier, where he was eventually captured by King Shapur I. Shapur proved to be a cruel victor. Having taken Valerian prisoner, he kept the fallen emperor alive as a trophy and delighted in regularly humiliating him. According to the 4th century writer Lactantius, whenever Shapur wished to mount his horse or chariot, Valerian was made to offer his back, and the king placed his foot on the Roman emperor as a step. After a long period as a human footstool, writes Lactantius, Valerian was turned into a macabre scarecrow. He was finally flayed alive, and his skin, filled with straw and dyed red, was displayed in a Persian temple as a perpetual memory of the king's victory. To be sure, the historical accuracy of this story is debated. It comes from the sensational On the Deaths of the Persecutors by Lactantius, a Christian author who despised Valerian's mistreatment of Christians, while other historical sources describe Valerian's capture and mockery by the Persians and a relief at Nashk-e-Rostam in modern-day Iran depicts him in captivity, no other references to his flaying have survived. And that completes the first article today. The title was The Roman Emperor Who Died From Eating Too Much Cheese by Candida Moss. Our next article is titled This Underrated Louisiana Parish Is Brimming with Cajun Culture. St. Martin Parish offers a glimpse into the storied heritage of Acadiana, a Louisiana region that's renowned for its savory seafood and lively music scene. It's by Jared Ranahan. With more than 40 million visitors recorded in 2024, Louisiana draws domestic and international tourists in droves thanks to its rich cultural heritage, scenic swamps, and thriving seafood scene. To encounter all three, St. Martin Parish is the ideal destination. Established along Louisiana's Atchafalaya Basin, this storied region offers a glimpse into the idyllic side of the Pelican State, imbued with southern live oaks and tranquil ponds that teem with crayfish. From the heart of St. Martinville to the depths of the bayou, St. Martin Parish embodies the beauty of rural Louisiana, featuring centuries-old cultural institutions and polished contemporary venues that hum with the enduring spice of Cajun culture. Exploring the culture of Acadiana. Over the centuries, Louisiana's indigenous Black and European communities have all played a crucial role in contributing to the state's overall cultural identity. St. Martin Parish serves as the ideal place for a deep dive into the region's French heritage. St. Martin Parish has long been touted as the birthplace of Cajun culture. Exiles from Acadie, now known as Nova Scotia, were welcomed to South Louisiana by the Spanish colonial government beginning in 1764, says Philip Frey, ranger at the Longfellow Evangeline State Historic Site. This 18th century influx of French-speaking refugees significantly contributed heavily to shaping the cultural landscape of southern Louisiana, earning the region the name Acadiana, due to its high concentration of Cajun settlers, and St. Martin Parish offers plenty of destinations for exploring their past. Upon arrival, the aforementioned Longfellow Evangeline State Historic Site is one way visitors can explore Acadiana culture. Once home to a cattle farm and later a 400-acre sugar plantation, the estate was converted into a state park in 1934. It now seeks to highlight the many cultural identities that have shaped Acadiana over the centuries. During a stroll along its grounds, guests are welcome to explore the replica farmstead for an idea of daily life in Acadiana during the 1700s. The on-site museum is a collection of centuries-old artifacts, including farming tools, textiles, and antique furniture. Post-tour, St. Martinville's African American Museum is an insightful experience that highlights the contributions and achievements of Acadiana's Black community. A 20-minute drive north of the museum, La Poussière is recognized as one of the oldest Cajun dance halls in the region, drawing guests on Saturdays and Sundays to enjoy the Cajun music of southern Louisiana. Sampling the best seafood in St. Martin Parish. Between museum visits, tourists can also explore Acadiana's renowned dining scene, which includes a myriad of dishes that showcase the region's natural bounty. "This is an area that's very rich in culinary history," says Marcel Bienvenu, cookbook author and food historian. "There was a large influx of people, the French, the English, the Germans, the natives. Everybody had a finger in the pot, and it was the best of every part of cuisine that came to this area." In terms of local dishes, Bienvenu highlights time-honored staples like crawfish étouffée, boiled crawfish, and crawfish pie, all of which people can try at the Brough Bridge Crawfish Festival. First celebrated in 1960, this lively event honors one of St. Martin's most prominent agricultural products. More than 20 million pounds of wild-caught and farm-raised crawfish are produced across the parish each year. Throughout the festival, visitors are welcome to snack on all sorts of savory seafood dishes, and you can peruse plenty of crustacean-themed memorabilia along the way. And while food is the main focus of the festival, it also doubles as a prime opportunity for immersion into Cajun culture, including traditional dance lessons and live Zydeco music performances. While Brough Bridge is a top-tier culinary destination, thanks to both the festival and local restaurants, such as Café Sidney May, it's far from the only place worth visiting for gastronomy buffs. Just 20 minutes away, the parish seat of St. Martinville is also steeped in Acadiana culture, earning the nickname Petit Paris due to its close cultural ties to France. Today, visitors can take a morning stroll in the tranquil Evangeline Oak Park, then head to the studio gallery and coffee bar for a latte and a slice of quiche. However, no visit is complete without dining at the St. John Restaurant, a cozy institution that's earned widespread acclaim for its crab cakes and ribeye steak. Discovering the tranquil beauty of the Acadiana Bayou. While Acadiana's distinct cultural heritage makes it a top-tier tourist destination, it's not just humans that call the region home. The surrounding basin acts as a crucial sanctuary for countless North American species. The aptly named Basin Landing offers ample opportunity to spot one of Acadiana's most famous creatures in the flesh. Equipped with a fleet of airboats and traditional swamp boats, this family-owned adventure company brings explorers into the depths of the Acadiana Bayou, where towering bald cypress trees and a wealth of native fauna await, including Louisiana black bears and 400 species of birds. While bird watchers marvel at picturesque species like the osprey, anhinga, and great egret, the tour is also perfect for getting an up-close view of the American alligator. This iconic reptile can be found in abundance here. After a wildlife-filled cruise along the bayou, guests are welcome to hop off the boat and feast on shrimp po' boys, seafood platters, and gator bites at the open-air Turtles Bar and Grill. But for a truly unforgettable foray into the flavors of Acadiana, don't miss out on Bayo Teche Brewing. Named in honor of one of the region's most prominent water features, this colorful venue blends traditional Cajun culture with modern gastronomy. Every Sunday, visitors can look forward to live Cajun music performed on the outdoor stage, along with locally inspired menu items that range from smoked Bowden pate to ale infused with raw Louisiana cane sugar. It's an example of the many unique places across Acadiana that seamlessly blend old-school Cajun tradition with modern flair. And that completes the article. The title was "This Underrated Louisiana Parish is Brimming with Cajun Culture." And that also completes the broadcast. We have run out of time. You've been listening to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program. The two articles I've read were published in November of 2025 by the Geographic Society. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and thank you so much for spending your time with me today.